You've got this evidence of kind of a co-conspirator, certainly a conspirator after the fact and an accessory. What else can you get?
He's definitely a serial sexual offender and just a horrible, horrible person.
I said to him, I said, do you watch shows like CSI and things like that? I said, technology now is incredible compared to what it was back in the 80s. I said, there may be a time when we come knocking on your door.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor, producer extraordinaire with XG Productions. Jim, we are right in the middle of a terrible and gripping cold case with, I have to say, our new favorite guest. And he is?
I'm Chris McMullen from Bensalem.
Thanks for coming back, Chris. And we can't wait to hear the rest of this really horrible, gruesome tale. But we really appreciate you sharing with us, because I believe every time we hear about a case like this, we have an opportunity to educate the public about how things went down and hopefully how we can stop these bad guys from doing what they do and help protect, as in this case, a very wonderful, innocent girl from a terrible fate.
Yeah, so let's jump right back in. Before you talk about writing George R. a letter, which is fascinating, I want to ask you about these nonverbal cues. We have a lot of true crime aficionados, obviously, that listen to the podcast and have heard Jim Clemente talk about this. Jim and I both lectured on nonverbal cues and what it means. You said that you thought Sanders was lying, even though he was saying words. You know, he wasn't admitting that he was lying, but you thought he was. What were some of those nonverbal cues?
You know, he wouldn't face me. You know, a lot of times he kept looking down, he kept looking away, he kept touching his face. You know, I remember when I went to polygraph school, I was told if somebody keeps going like that, what they're telling you stinks. You know, and I kind of believed it. It seemed like it was good advice.
Yeah, a lot of times what we teach is that it's changes in behavior. I mean, you're talking to him, you're establishing rapport, he's telling you things, he's communicating with you in a certain way. And then at certain times, he changes that behavior, and it could be those hand movements or...
Because he's channeling anxiety.
Yeah, and he's also, he's not focusing on the content of what he's saying. He's focusing on creating it and also convincing you of what is...
Right, he's manufacturing. You know, you ask him a question, and instead of answering it, he repeats it back to you, because while he repeats it back, he's buying time so he can manufacture a lie.
There you go.
Okay, so... all this is going on. The case is still unsolved. You're waiting for the endless tests at the FBI to finish. So you write George Shaw a letter. How did that come about? And what did you say to him?
I took some, I don't want to say heat for it, but there was a lot of people that were kind of shocked by it. And I was I was just to a point where I was frustrated, because I felt like we weren't getting anywhere. And I honestly wanted to talk to him on the phone, and I wanted him to know. I said, at this point, I want him to know we're looking. Now, right. Would I ever do that again? I don't know. But I wrote him a letter, and there was no mistaking who I was or why I was writing him. I wrote him a letter on police department letterhead. Mm. It said, regarding case number 84-17505, homicide investigation. And I still have the letter. And, you know, I said, you know, I would like to speak with you. And don't, you know, he called me back.
Really?
Yeah. He left me a voicemail, and, you know, caller ID is a beautiful thing. So I had his number, and I called him back, and, we small talked for a minute or two. You know, I asked him how he was and thanked him for calling me. And he told me that he was kind of busy lately because he had been taking care of his mother and things like that. You know, we started talking, and at some point, you know, I segued into it. I said, you know, I said, well, you were interviewed about this case, and he started to get defensive, and I remember he had said that he had done everything that those cops wanted him to do, and he referred to us as Nazis. But what I found interesting was he wasn't portraying as this tough guy that reputation that I had been given about him. He actually started to get a little nervous, and he started stuttering and tripping over his words. And it just got to the point where, you know, I had said to him, I said, George, we're still looking at this case, and I'm going to be very honest with you. You're still number one on our list. And I said to him, I said, do you watch, you know, television shows like CSI and things like that? I said, you know, technology now is incredible compared to what it was back in the 80s. I said, and, you know, there may be a time when we come knocking on your door.
First of all, I don't know if we ever got an answer as to what actually was in that FBI lab report in 2010.
You would mention about the ends matching. They didn't match the ends, but basically they were able to tell us that the tape was alike in material, fiber, filament, everything, that it was basically the identical tape, and that it came from the same source was what they told us. And we had had it on record that an employee of that company worked there and gave George Shaw those rolls of tape, and we had taken those rolls of tape from George Shaw's apartment.
So that's really good evidence as a prosecutor, but I'm still not sure that's enough for murder charges. I mean, it's good, but I don't know. I might hesitate.
And they didn't get any fingerprints or DNA off of that tape?
No, they tried, but there was none there. And, you know, I mean, by the time it was submitted, it was years old. Mm-hmm. Although I realize it could have been there, but it wasn't. They tried. But what we really needed, and I remember when I was speaking to one of the original investigators, he passed away. His name is Dave Rowland. He had told me, he said, Sanders is the key to this case. And I agreed with him, and he was right. So fast forward to around August of 2012, I had just finished a trial, and it was a big case. It was about a 3-year investigation involving a serial sex offender. We had well over 20 victims with this guy. And when the case was done, the prosecutor on the case was a prosecutor named Jennifer Shorn. And I had asked her, I had basically made copies of all the Rowan case files, and I brought them to her. And I said, I would really like it if you would read this case. I told her about the case and what it was, and I said, I believe it's solvable. And, you know, I felt that, you know, she had the tenacity that it would take. And that was how I got it into her hands. It took a few years yet, because we didn't go to grand jury until spring of 2015. But once we got into grand jury, that's when we started to pick up speed.
Okay. So you've got a lab result from the FBI. You have Sanders' kind of vague statements. I feel like you need something else. So what else do you get?
We need the truth from Sanders. He at the time was living in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, which is in Monroe County, up in the Poconos area. And Mike and I drove up there one day, and we knew where he was living. And we actually, we were working with a detective up there, and they were aware of him. They knew who he was. And went onto a fictitious Facebook account and started talking with him, and made him think that who he was talking to was a girl at a bar up the street who wanted to meet him. And he left his house and came walking up the street, and we intercepted him at the corner.
Okay. So you talked to him. What does he say?
We brought him back to the Monroe County detectives, and we sat down with him and we interviewed him, and he just kept saying, you know, there's nothing to talk about. And he kept denying any further knowledge, and basically was, you know, saying that he had told us everything in 1984 and again in 05 or 06 when he was in Montgomery County prison. And I think, we hit him out of the blue. He hadn't seen us in years. So then what we decided to do was we wanted to talk to him again, but we wanted to have his girlfriend interviewed also, the one that he'd been on the phone with. But what I wanted to do was, I said, I wanted to do the interviews simultaneously, because I don't want him in the middle of the interview to say, oh, I want to talk to my girlfriend again, because I wanted her to be getting interviewed at the same time. If he wanted to talk, fine, we'll take it down the hallway, because guess who happens to be here? And that was kind of how we did it. So
right. We
got help from some of the other guys that I work with, and also that Mike works with. And we did that. And then we also had subpoenas for them to appear in grand jury. So his girlfriend, Donna, she kept saying she was just, oh, I can't remember. I can't remember. I can't remember. And it was, again, she was lying through her teeth. So Sanders was the first one in grand jury. And basically, even when he got to court, he was, you know, he was very uncooperative, but ultimately he gave it up and he said, yeah, I was there. I saw her. I was in the apartment. Wow. She was there. And we're like, who was there? And he said, the little girl, the one with the red hair.
Wow.
That she was actually in Shaw's apartment when he got there to shoot meth with Shaw.
And so what was she doing in the apartment? Was she restrained? What was happening?
She was actually watching Shaw's little girl. And then what happened was, according to him, he sat in the living room and got high, and Shaw took the girl into another room, and about 30 to 40 minutes, he heard noises, and about 30 to 40 minutes later, Shaw came out of the room and he was sweaty and amped up. And he was telling Sanders that he screwed up really bad.
Wow.
And then Sanders went into the room, and Barbara was in the room, and she was lifeless. She was deceased.
It's horrifying. Yeah. It's just horrifying that he then covers it up for so long.
Yeah, no. And that was one of the things I kept saying to him to finally get him to tell the truth. Like I said, you know, I said, for 30 years, you've been getting locked up for drugs and alcohol. Did you ever stop to think that maybe because you're carrying this around is why you keep, you know, self-medicating like this? And then his girlfriend in grand jury, she was terrified to tell the truth. So we had to make it clear to her that just because somebody else told you they did this, like, you know, the fact that you didn't report it to the police definitely is immoral, but it's, you're not going to be charged for that. And ultimately then she corroborated what Sanders said. And she told us, and she had a really hard time. I mean, she almost vomited on the, from the witness stand when she was telling the story. Mm. But she basically, you know, told us that Bobby told her what happened, and she told the same story.
Wow.
You got this evidence of kind of a co-conspirator, certainly a conspirator after the fact, and an accessory after the fact. You've got the duct tape, which is decent evidence. You certainly have him there. You've got his little girl that Barbara would watch. So what do you do?
We then found another report that had been made back in 84 of a man and a woman who had been driving north on Route 1 on the evening of August 3rd, 1984, and they saw a red car on the shoulder of the road with two guys, and the trunk was open. And the husband actually said to his wife jokingly, hey, it looks like they're dumping a body.
Mm.
And, you know, that report had been made back in 1984. Now, you know, why they didn't pursue that more, I don't know. But we looked that gentleman up. His last name was Green, Mr. Green. His wife, unfortunately, had passed away, but he was still alive and well. And the descriptions that they had given, one of them had described one of the men, they're both white males. One was described as a white male, thin, with long, sandy blonde hair, wearing what was described as a painter's cap. Bobby Sanders used to wear rebel soldier caps.
Hmm.
And he even told us that he was wearing it that night. And the other description was a husky, burly white male with dark hair and dark rimmed glasses and a thick mustache. That's George Shaw.
Wow.
Wow.
And where he described the car being was literally where the body was found.
That's incredible corroboration. All right. So you've got George Shaw, you think. Does your prosecutor agree with you? And what do you do?
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
They do. And Shaw was in Florida at the time. And the original plan was for us to go to Florida and give him a subpoena to bring him into grand jury. And unfortunately, we got some wires crossed because when we got down there, it was in Seminole County, Florida. He was living in a town called Geneva. And we had made a contact down there with the Seminole County Sheriff's Department, a detective named Jennifer Spears, who was phenomenal. All she does is work cold cases. And she had done a lot of surveillance for us and whatnot. But after we got down there and speaking with the Florida state attorney, if Shaw didn't want to come back for grand jury, Florida will not compel one of their citizens to go somewhere if it's for self-incrimination purposes. So basically that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, the Florida attorney was like, listen, I've read your reports. I think you have probable cause for an arrest. And we all felt that way. But, you know, the original plan was to try and get him to come back. So that didn't happen. So what we did was we said, OK, well, we're going to go to his house and we're going to try and do a non-custodial interview with him first and see if he'll talk. So that's exactly what we did. It didn't go that well, but we went to his house and he was actually sitting out on his front patio smoking when we got there. And told him who we were and that we were in town and that we wanted to talk to him about the investigation from 1984.
And how did he react? Was he surprised? Was he scared? Was he, you know, relieved? What?
He was stoic. He was just kind of playing his cool. I mean, I definitely wasn't happy that we were there, but he wasn't relieved. And if he was surprised, he wasn't showing it. And we talked a little bit and we asked him, you know, we said, you know, how long he'd been living down there. And he actually told us, he said, you know what happened up in Pennsylvania, right? And I said, he said, I killed someone. And he took us back for a second, but what happened was he accidentally killed somebody at a construction site with a piece of construction equipment. And apparently with a backloader or something like that. And it sounded like a terrible accident. I don't know all the details of it, but he had said that was why he left Pennsylvania and came down there. But ultimately, you know, we said to him, like, you know, would you consider coming back to the sheriff's department with us so we could sit down and just do a formal interview with you? And he was like, nope, we're done here. And he got up and he tried to kind of push his way past us. And at that point, we just took him into custody, took him back to the sheriff's department. And we attempted an interview, but, you know, shortly into it, he asked for an attorney.
So then was he extradited back to Pennsylvania for, you know, to stand trial for Barbara's murder?
Yep. That's exactly what happened.
And tell us what I'm dying to know. How did it go?
Sanders was also arrested. He was not charged with homicide. He was charged with hindering the apprehension of a felon. And he was, you know, our star witness, obviously. So Shaw had opted. He had gotten a very good attorney. His family, his mother, I don't know if she took out another mortgage on her house or, but I mean, because I remember at the preliminary hearing, or excuse me, at the arraignment, when bail was set, he had said, my family's, you know, liquidating funds to, you know, to hire me a private attorney. And I remember he had had a really good legal team, but ultimately he opted for a bench trial instead of a jury trial.
Well, that's a guy who knows he's guilty.
You know, we had a bench trial instead. Now, he was arrested in late September of 2015. The trial wasn't until August of 17, because it got pushed back for various reasons.
And did Barbara's parents attend the trial?
They did. Mr. Rowan testified. He did very well. He after he testified, he didn't come back. At the time, I mean, this was 5 years ago, he was well into his 70s then. But he was very honest. He was like, I can't be in the room with that guy. And, you know, who could blame him? Mm-hmm. But he did a phenomenal job testifying.
Did he remember going to their house and asking if his daughter was there?
He testified about it. Yeah, he testified.
Jim, I don't know how anyone can live with that. That's, you know, knowing now, you know, decades later that his little girl was inside that house when he went there has to continue to eat him alive. That's just horrifying.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And they are literally, he and his wife, they're very, very nice people. They're just... When we called them that evening after Shaw had been arrested, yeah, it was actually Mike that was on the phone with Mrs. Rowan. But when he called her and said, you know, who he was, she just paused and she said, are you calling about my daughter? Mm. And he said, yes. And, you know, she said, yeah. And I don't know. I can't remember if she said it on the phone that night, but when we met her the next day, she said, you know, I literally thought that this case was forgotten about. They're just really simple, very humble, nice people that wouldn't hurt anybody. And like, they didn't even, I mean, God forbid that something like that happened to somebody I care about. I'm every day, I want an update, you know, like these people, they were just, you know, they had just kind of accepted it reluctantly and did the best.
Thank you for digging in and doing this. But I want to ask, in terms of the timeline, when that couple saw these guys on the side of the road with their red car and the trunk open, when was that with respect to when she actually went missing and when her father...
It was August 3rd. It was the same day that she went missing.
After the father went to the house.
Yes. It was after. Because after the father left was then when... Shaw basically, with the help of Sanders, removed her from the house with the car. And, you know, I can't tell you exactly how long, but it was shortly after Mr. Rowan had been there.
Yeah, so she was already dead. It's just a terrible, terrible tragedy.
He gets tried. He's charged with murder of some sort, I assume?
Unfortunately, we didn't make out a first-degree murder case in the eyes of the court. He was convicted of third-degree murder, which... I wasn't thrilled about, but...
And what's the penalty for that, Chris?
Well, the real kicker with that was that we had to use the statutes as they were in 1984 versus...
I know, that's the tough thing about cold cases.
Yeah, so in 1984, in Pennsylvania, third-degree murder had a sentence of 10 to 20 years, whereas now it's 20 to 40. Hmm. So ultimately, he was convicted of that, and he was convicted of... attempted sexual assault. Ultimately, he got a maximum of 29 and a half years, which at his age, you know, could be the rest of his life.
And that was in 2017, Chris?
That was when the conviction was in 20. So if he got credit for time served when he went in 2015, I think he was 55 years old. So, you know, if he does the whole sentence, which, you know, I pray that he does, you know, he's going to be well into his 80s before he's able to get out of jail.
How is your sentencing parole board judges? How are they with respect to keeping murderers like this in prison where they belong?
It was made clear to me that when the judge handed down the sentence and the things he put on the record, that it should be abundantly clear to the parole board that this man should do the maximum of his sentence.
I like you. I pray that he does. Did you all ever find out that he'd ever victimized any other children? This just seems weird to me to think that it's a one-off.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's... So I'm going to take you back to 1984 again. So Barbara disappears and then her body is found in 1984. Shaw is investigated for it. He was interviewed a few times by the Bensalem police back then, but he would not admit to it, and they couldn't put it on him at the time. And he up and moves. He maybe only lived in that apartment here for 2 months. And in September of 84, he leaves and he goes back to Montgomery County. So literally 2 months to the day that Barbara's body was discovered, which was, it would have been October 16th of 1984, Channel 6 Action News in Philadelphia, used to have a, I think they still have a site, it's called Crime Fighters. And they ran a story on the Barbara Rowan case and on 11 o'clock news. And just before midnight that same night, an elderly woman who lived about two blocks from where Shaw was now living on Montgomery County, somebody broke into her home through a window, strangled her, sexually assaulted her, probably was trying to kill her, but she fought him off and he left. And she described her attacker as having thick rim glasses. They did find fingerprints at the point of entry, but this was before APHIS existed. So they couldn't run those prints like we would do today. So again, fast forward a few months into the spring of 85, in the same neighborhood, the police were called because about a peeping Tom incident. And there was a teenage girl in her bedroom, and apparently a guy was peeking in the window at her. And the teenage girl's father and brother confronted this guy in their driveway and apparently started to beat him up and held him there until the police arrived. And this man was George Shaw. So the officer, I mentioned him way back in the beginning, his name was Tidwell. He was the one that went to Montgomery County Prison with us. He was pretty sharp. And he said, I wonder if this is the guy that broke into that elderly woman's home back in the fall. And he took Shaw's fingerprints and he compared them to fingerprints at the point of entry in that house, and they matched. So Shaw was charged with that crime, which he denied. And unfortunately, the elderly woman was very reluctant to go to court. Apparently, she had health problems. She was in early stages of dementia. And it was pled down. And what he probably could have done, you know, years for in jail, I think he did, you know, 12 months in county jail.
What a shame.
It is. And I know that because Jennifer and I, we got the notes of testimony from that case, and we got the case file from Montgomery County and looked in it. And there was a note in it from the original prosecutor saying that that the case had been pled down because the victim was not able to testify. But make no mistake, this was a full-blown rape. And, you know, she wanted, you know, I guess, that to be on the record. So he got off light then too. Oh. We had also, Mike and I, in our investigation, found two other women that had said he had sexually assaulted them when using meth. And so that was at least three people there. And then there was an incident in Florida where he apparently had exposed himself to a minor, and that was on record down there. But apparently there was never charges filed on it. And to be quite honest, I was never really privy to the case file, and I don't know exactly why or what happened with that either.
It seems to me like he would be classified as a sexually diverse preferential offender. In other words, his preference is to offend, but he doesn't have a preference in terms of age or even the type of crime he commits, but he's definitely a serial sexual offender and just a horrible, horrible person. But we're at that point now where we have to ask you that age-old question for best case, worst case, which is this for you a best case or a worst case?
I think that's kind of like the best of times or worst of times. It's the worst case because of what happened to Barbara Rowan, you know, and her family. It's definitely the worst for them. I guess it's, you know, for me, it's one of my best investigations. Absolutely. It's something that, you know, it's, you know, long after I retire, this is the one I'll remember. So in that case, it's the best case. Unfortunately, what happened is probably one of the worst cases that's ever happened here in our township. But I'm just glad that although we didn't get the first degree murder conviction that we wanted, I mean, he walked around for 31 years free, you know, so he owes us some time. And, you know,
you got him. He's in jail.
I mean, I'd have preferred that it had never happened. And I know a lot of other people feel that way.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. I mean, it's, you know, it's a real tribute to your dogged determination to pursue this case over decades.
You know, and I have to tell you that I would have never done this without Mike and Jen and some of the other people involved. You know, you have to pick your team well. And, you know, I knew that he was, you know, he took me to school and that he taught me a lot. And Jen as a prosecutor was phenomenal. So, you know, anybody that is trying to solve a cold case, you got to pick your team wisely.
Well said.
Yeah, only I had done that when I started this podcast.
Stop it. Jim, don't feed into people. There are people online who say that already.
Oh, really? They what don't know what they're Francie? Talking
She's
about.
She's annoying.
Oh, she, well.
Stop it.
I'm not
You're
saying.
Feeding that, right in.
What did I say? No, I
Unbelievable.
Didn't say that, did I?
Where's Hello? The defense of me, Jim? Your podcasting
I
partner.
I am, Francie, obviously. I chose you because you're amazing, and you are that prosecutor who could do anything.
Thank you.
Even when you have really difficult cases. So
thanks.
I do poke fun of you a little bit because, you know, you give me much more hell.
Grief.
But anyway,
I like to give grief, but Chris, it's great to have Chris, hasn't it?
Thank
Jim?
You so much for coming.
Thanks for having
me. A really illuminating case, and unfortunately, we're incredibly saddened by what happened to little Barbara, and we hope that her parents are doing okay.
Yeah, family's good people. Family's really good people.
Good. Well, I believe that wraps up this episode of Best Case, Worst Case. Till next time, thank you for listening. Signing out.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness Delight can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.